It is Friday, the 26th of February, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, Iran about to hold a first election since the nuclear deal.
This election is honestly the first election after Iran deal. So many countries like U.S., they are interested to see what Iranian people think about that.
Also ahead, more sanctions possible for North Korea, looking ahead to a big election next week in the U.S., plus diversity, an issue at the Academy Awards. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Iran's reformists are hoping to win their strongest presence in Parliament since 2004 as hardliners try to stave off a blow to their power in nationwide elections later today. This is the first time Iranians have been to the polls since Tehran's landmark nuclear deal with the West. International Edition's Peter Heinlein joins us now for more on the election.
Thanks, Steve. With us today is Arash Sigarchi, the Internet Managing Editor of VOA's Persian News Network. Arash, tell us about the significance of this election we're seeing today.
On Friday, we have a two election in Iran. First is for, selecting parliament member in Iran, which is, in past 10 years, Iranian a conservative government and parliament were in office. So this is first time for them after, choosing President Rouhani, who got a deal with Western countries. They have an opportunity to choose a new parliament who can be inside of government. And another big election is, Assembly of Experts, who is in charge to selecting next Iran supreme leader. The period of the service for Assembly of Experts is not like a other parliament for 4 years. It is for 8 years. And we know Mr. Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, was sick 2 years ago. And many people in Iran believe that the next Assembly of Experts is in charge to choose next Iran supreme leader.
Well, tell me, this is a defining moment, obviously, for Iran and for the world. Why is it so significant to the United States? Why are the United States and the Western countries so interested in what's happening here?
I think the most reason they are interested to see the result of this election is because this election is honestly the first election after Iran deal. So many countries like U.S., they are interested to see what Iranian people think about that. Keep in mind, the previous government in Iran wasn't agreed to have a deal with U.S. and other Western countries. But the new government, since almost 3 years ago, they got a deal and they hope to have a better relation with U.S. and European countries. So if people choose reformists and, middle politician, that is a significant message for U.S. and Western countries.
Well, what can we expect in the way of what we're going to see happening in Tehran and in the broader Iranian countryside today?
Extremists who they are close to supreme leader, they don't want to lose in this election because, they had a government, they had a parliament for 10 years, and suddenly, 3 years ago, they lost the election for presidential, and they are using their power to not losing again for parliament, and especially in Assembly of Experts election, because if they lose this election, they will lose everything.
Well, thank you, Arash. That's very good analysis. We hope to hear more from you as the day goes on and as we watch the Iranian polity progress.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
And many thanks to you, Pete. International Edition's Peter Heinlein speaking with Arash Sigarchi of VOA's Persian News Network.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Here in Washington, President Obama met Thursday with his national security team, including the Secretary of State John Kerry and Defense Chief Ashton Carter. The situation in Syria and Iraq in the fight against the Islamic State, sometimes referred to as ISIL, dominated their discussion. After the meeting, Mr. Obama spoke to reporters.
At the outset, I want to say again that this remains a difficult fight. The situation in Syria and Iraq is one of the most complex the world has seen in recent times. ISIL's entrenched, including in urban areas, using innocent civilians as human shields. Even in places where ISIL's been driven out, it leaves behind utter devastation, communities in ruin that need to be stabilized and rebuilt, which will take years and tremendous international resources, because certainly in Iraq, they're hard-pressed to come up with everything that they need to rebuild. And in Syria, the regime there still is not constituted in such a way that it is investing in civilian populations. Countries, communities, and groups that agree on fighting ISIL in the short term often don't agree on broader long-term goals. Indeed, the fight in Syria is not only a civil war, but it's also a proxy war between regional powers, reflecting deep sectarian and political rivalries. Russia's intervention and airstrikes have reinforced the Assad regime and made a humanitarian catastrophe even worse. And the entire world's been horrified by images of starving Syrians, including children, reduced to near skeletons. So this is a tough situation with a lot of moving parts. And as a consequence, I want to thank John for his tireless efforts, along with his team, to reach a cessation of hostilities in the civil war. And none of us are under any illusions. We're all aware of the many potential pitfalls, and there are plenty of reasons for skepticism. But history would judge us harshly if we did not do our part in at least trying to end this terrible conflict with diplomacy.
President Obama speaking after a meeting Thursday with his national security team. For more on this story and the rest of the day's news, check out our website at voanews.com. Up next, the UN considering new sanctions against North Korea. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. The UN Security Council is considering unprecedented new sanctions against North Korea in response to its January nuclear test and that February rocket launch. The two North Korean moves violated four sets of existing international sanctions imposed on Pyongyang. The United States submitted a draft resolution on a new round of North Korea sanctions to the UN Security Council just a short time ago. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir has been following the developments, and my colleague Michael Lippin asked her how ready the council members are to proceed to a vote.
Well, I think they are ready because the main players in this drama are the United States and China. And the U.S. and China have worked for 7 weeks together to draft this resolution. It's technically a U.S.-drafted resolution, but they had a lot of input from the Chinese on it. So the U.S. and China have gone over it together. If the Chinese accept it, I don't see that any of the other 13 council members will have a big objection to it. There's some question whether Russia might agree to it. They don't like sanctions generally, but in the big picture of things, they need China, and China needs them, so they'll probably go along with it.
And what kind of sanctions are in this resolution?
Well, Ambassador Power spoke to reporters this afternoon after she circulated it in the Security Council in a closed meeting, and she said that there are very unprecedented measures in it, very tough measures, including, for instance, total arms embargo, which includes conventional weapons, which have often been used to generate revenue for North Korea for their illicit programs. It also, the resolution will also seek to impose a mandatory inspection of all cargo that goes in and out of North Korea, whether it's by land or by sea or by air, and that includes everything. I mean, food items, everything, in and out. So things are being, the screws are being turned tighter, shall we say, and there's going to be more banking sanctions, and there are also going to be sanctions on items such as refined petroleum, aviation fuel. So this could shut down the North Korean rocket program because they wouldn't have fuel to put in their rockets to launch them. So there's some really new and innovative sanctions here.
How are the members of the Security Council dealing with the long-running concern that tightening the screws in North Korea will really just hurt the people rather than the regime?
Right. Well, Ambassador Power was very clear in saying that these are sanctions that are intended to target the government, but not the people. They know that the people have suffered enough, and the government has chosen to, you know, put all its money on building its nuclear and ballistic missile program instead of feeding its people. So the U.S. and the international community don't want to make that situation worse.
Is there any sense of how this resolution will be enforced?
There are new enforcement mechanisms in it, but, you know, it's up to countries to abide by Security Council resolutions. They are international law, and yes, I know many of them haven't been enforced before, and, you know, we've had four rounds of sanctions on North Korea that haven't really made a dent in the situation. But if countries, you know, if this is fully implemented and fully enforced, they hope that it really will be a game changer.
And you expect to vote on this when exactly?
In the coming days, we're hearing possibly Saturday or Sunday. Countries have to take it back now, look it over. It's a long resolution. It's a very technical resolution. So even though we're not expecting any major objections to it, you know, you have to give countries the right of looking at it and deciding what they want to do, the council members.
VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking there with International Edition's Michael Lippin. You can follow Michael and Margaret on voanews.com. All their reporting is there. You can also find them on Twitter, Margaret at mbashir, and Michael is at michael_lippin. Well, speaking of social media, let's check in right now with International Edition's G. Abby Lee about what's being said online about efforts to rein in North Korea's nuclear ambitions. G., which Twitter handles do you recommend to keep posted on the issue?
Hi, Steve. The U.S. mission to the U.N. at USUN was quite prolific on Twitter Thursday. It retweeted from the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Samantha Powers account and also sent us some original tweets. Powers on Twitter at Ambassador Power, and her latest tweet about North Korea reads like this. Sanctions proposed today further restrict hashtag DPRK's ability to advance its nuclear program, would block access to funds, know-how, and technology. DPRK refers to the North official name of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
You know, gee, it seems almost ironic to use the word democratic in the official name of North Korea.
Oh, absolutely. Steve, I asked our Facebook audience what their thoughts are on this issue and received some very intriguing comments. I can't share all of them, but here are the snippets. A user named Galrong Karma wrote, DPRK and China are wearing the same shoes, meaning they're allies in this case. DPRK is strong enough to do everything it wants because it knows that China will back it up all the time. Hence, China is definitely not the right country to speak with regarding any issue about DPRK and its misconduct. Another listener named Vin Vu asked, the cooperation between China and the U.S. on the issue of sanctions on North Korea would be a disaster to that regime, wouldn't it? That's a valid question because some analysts are sharing Vu's view. They're warning that sanctions against the North could fuel regional tensions and increase the risk of war.
I see. What about the reactions from China on the joint agreement between Washington and Beijing?
As you know, people in China can access Twitter easily, so it's quite hard to get a pulse on the public opinion. But here's what the state-owned CCTV News tweeted. FM, that's Foreign Minister Wang Yi, "We are against the development of nuclear weapons by the DPRK. The Korean Peninsula must be denuclearized." That's all for me today. Back to you, Steve.
And many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. And we turn now to U.S. presidential politics, where Democratic presidential contenders Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders will be facing off in the South Carolina primary on Saturday. Meanwhile, contenders from both parties are also looking ahead to more than a dozen states that will hold contests on March 1st, the so-called Super Tuesday primary and caucuses. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has our report.
We are not going to let voting rights be undermined and suppressed.
Democrat Hillary Clinton courts African-American voters in South Carolina, the first test in the Democratic race that features a large percentage of minority voters.
I also believe that if we work together to make major new investments in communities that have been left behind and guarantee justice and dignity to every American, that will benefit all of us.
Our next president, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Rival Bernie Sanders is also appealing to black voters with celebrity help from actor Danny Glover. Sanders is more focused on upcoming Super Tuesday contests in Missouri and Oklahoma.
We have taken on the political establishment. We've taken on the media establishment, and our momentum is growing every day.
Contenders from both parties are focused on the Super Tuesday contest, where hundreds of delegates are at stake. Republican frontrunner Donald Trump leads in the opinion polls in several of the Super Tuesday states and hopes to build off his latest victory in Nevada.
We won the evangelicals. We won with young. We won with old. We won with highly educated. We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated.
Senator Marco Rubio hopes to emerge as Trump's main rival.
So you have a very hardcore majority of Republicans that do not want Donald Trump as the nominee. And as long as they're being divided up by three or four people, it's good for Donald. But that's not going to continue.
Elections are about choices.
But Rubio continues to battle Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who finished third in Nevada.
The only campaign that has beaten Donald Trump and the only campaign that can beat Donald Trump is this campaign.
Also campaigning for Super Tuesday delegates are Ohio Governor John Kasich and retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, both trailing well behind Trump. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And many thanks to you, Jim. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
It's been slow going at this construction site on the Greek island of Kos. This migrant processing center is a refugee hotspot, and locals fear what it could do to business. Resident Maria Kanto. She says, "I believe the government should have examined this seriously. It should not have allowed for this to happen so as to protect other things, our economy above all." Financially challenged Greece is the main gateway for migrants from the Middle East, Asia, and Africa. The EU demanded Greece open five centers, and this being the final center, designed for 6,000 migrants on an island with a population of 30,000. The locals have protested the center, and resident Ayana Grabani is concerned for a number of reasons.
Along with refugees, illegal immigrants who are dangerous also come. We worry for our families, children, and our jobs.
Recently, 6,000 more refugees flooded the island, but hotel bookings on Kos are down dramatically. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Rapper Kanye West has taken his emotions to Twitter, accusing the Grammy Awards of racism and asking for a meeting with the head of the Recording Academy. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the incident and what resulted from it.
Well, you know, Kanye has this habit of using Twitter as his, I call it like his personal diary. You know, these are the things that late at night you're supposed to write down in your diary, streams of consciousness, if dear, you will. Dear diary, right, today. They don't necessarily make sense. And the reality is most people don't care, but you just got to get it off your chest. Well, this is what Kanye has been doing for the last few weeks. And on Wednesday, those of us who follow him were blessed with 36 tweets in a row about so many things, as you mentioned, the main issue being his problem with the Grammy Awards. And let's be clear that this is not a new thing for Kanye. This is just a new set of tweets about an issue that he's been talking about for years and years and years. So, yes, he tweeted. The first tweet was very simply, I would like to sit down with Neil Portnow right now. And he went on to talk about the Grammys being important, but there are a lot of artists that are not being recognized and the awarding system is way off and completely out of touch, and that, you know, he is the most important living artist talking. And I'm quoting, if I'm not at the show next year, then there is no show. On and on and on and on. And then he ends it with, I got a new album coming out this summer. Well, now, he also said something in the middle of this, accusing the Grammys in a non-subtle way of racism. He said, you guys are supposed to be all about taste. And he said, you like your black people a certain way. Also, you wouldn't have Future perform, and that man owned the clubs last summer. Right, talking about Future, the producer. And he went on to talk about a few other artists that he really wanted to have featured. But what I thought was really interesting was the response from Neil Portnow. Like, a lot of times he'll go after people and they'll kind of ignore him. But the Recording Academy CEO and the president, Neil Portnow, came out and said, quote, Kanye West is a creative pioneer who has been recognized and honored by the Recording Academy time and time again. We value his input as a member of the creative community, and he welcomes Kanye to engage in a direct and productive dialogue about the future of music. So he actually went on and tweeted, you know, and I'm paraphrasing here, hey, I'm not on Twitter, but if you want to meet, let's do this. So, I don't know. Maybe this time Kanye's Twitter rant will actually end in some productive conversation and change to the Recording Academy, which I think a lot of artists would like to see. You know, I wonder, okay, how much of this is actual expression of the person's feelings? And how much of this is their marketing department saying, if you do this, you will get traction and your album will get attention? Well, I think Kanye has an evil genius in his head. You know, I think it's the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other. Because Kanye does this on stage as well. So this isn't just what we see on Twitter. We're going to see this on any stage that he gets on and is allowed any, you know, time that he's not singing or dancing to say something. He's going to continue to let everyone know what's on his mind, whether or not it makes logical sense. All right, Kanye, he's going to say it. So who knows? All right. Well, what do you think? You can send us a tweet on Twitter at VOA underscore IE for International Edition. You can also hit Shauna up. Her handle is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music.
You know, movie stars will be gathering this weekend, in fact, in Hollywood on Sunday for the annual Academy Awards, sometimes called the Oscars. Some Hollywood observers have criticized the lack of diversity among this year's nominees, all of whom are white. But as VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports, Hollywood does have another side of that that's more diverse than the Hollywood stars we actually see on display at the Oscars.
Cameroon-born actress and producer Constance Ijeoma is showing her film Ben and Ara at film festivals worldwide. It has a 2016 release date, so is not up for an Oscar. The film is a complex love story that tackles many themes.
Interracial, intercultural, interreligious. I think, you know, people can relate to all or one of those three things. So it is very relevant for our times.
Ben and Ara tells the tale of two graduate students, one an atheist and the other a Muslim. It deals with relationships, faith, family, and cultural tensions. A film called Echo Park stars Tony Okomboa, a British-Nigerian actor and producer. It's a romantic drama set in a changing neighborhood of Los Angeles that deals with universal themes of love and conflict.
I just want the story to be the important part, and the actors
can be interchanged with any culture.
The 2014 historical drama Selma told the story of American civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. It won an Oscar for its original song, Glory. Its director, Ava DuVernay, is distributing Okomboa's film through a collective that she founded. She is a rarity in Hollywood, a mainstream director who is African-American and female.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Academy Awards nominees, class of 2015.
This year's Oscar nominees are overwhelmingly white. Tony Okomboa says the problem goes beyond individual movies.
While there were some films that could have been recognized this year, I still feel the bigger issue is there's not enough films being made that have diverse characters in them.
Financing and distribution are difficult, but Hollywood films are being made by international and minority artists.
And I think we do have a responsibility, people in my shoes, to continue telling our stories, regardless of whether or not we have the support of the mainstream to get it out there.
The filmmakers say the mainstream industry and award shows like the Oscars have some catching up to do to reflect the diversity that is already present in the industry. Ben and Ara has upcoming festival showings in Venice and in Cameroon. Echo Park has theatrical openings scheduled for Los Angeles and New York. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You know, you can find Mike's report on the internet at voanews.com. There are a lot of other reports there about what's coming up at the Oscars in just a couple of days. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It was very good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a recent speech at Stanford University, Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Tom Malinowski spoke of an age-old contest, the struggle between the desire of people to be free, to be treated with dignity, and to have control over their own lives, and the fundamentally authoritarian impulse that believes ordinary men and women are too small-minded to govern their own affairs. The impulse that fuels the dictator's desire to seize and cling to power. Today, the latter impulse, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski, is seen in its most extreme manifestation in ISIL, where terrorists seek to use the veneer of religious legitimacy to justify a thirst for control that includes the desire to kill, rape, and subjugate. But there are other places that reflect the authoritarian urge. Bashar al-Assad's Syria, with its brutal reaction to the aspirations of the Arab Spring. Vladimir Putin's Russia, where human rights organizations are now being vilified as traitors. China, where the government is lashing out at dissidents at home and kidnapping them abroad. But the ardent desire for people to control their own lives is also having its successes, said Mr. Malinowski. In Burma, where the people were able to cast their ballots for elected lawmakers for the first time in decades. In Sri Lanka, where the two communities that had long divided the country, the Sinhalese and Tamils, came together in an election to oust an authoritarian government. The United States, with its own ideals of democracy and the rule of law, has a great stake in the battle that is being waged. So it makes great sense, Mr. Malinowski said, that we defend people around the world who are trying peacefully to advance respect for human rights before conflict between power and people leads to devastating consequences. That we speak out when governments try to stifle dissent or control the internet or pollute their citizens' efforts and aspirations with corruption. Our hopes for the world may not be fully realized, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski, but the world is not falling apart. It is presenting a challenge to which we must rise. And if we keep doing so, I believe things will get better, slowly but surely.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
with four